A little fun with sound effects here, as I am actively engaged in putting out fires this month. Specifically, I've been completing a final step on my upcoming book project, soliciting and organizing, obtaining rights to well over 300 photos, which may be used as illustrations. There was a tight deadline with the book designer, so unfortunately, we were too busy to pull together a new show this month, and instead are rebroadcasting something seasonal, an episode from St. Patrick's Day 2020 on Banshees. I say we were too busy to do a new show because Mrs. Carswell, a very close associate of hers, Sarah Chavez, has also been busy with the release of her new book. Just came out a little over a week ago, a charming children's book called We Need to Talk About Death, an important book about grief, celebration, and love. But not to worry, we'll be back with a fresh episode for you in the month of April. Meanwhile, cozy up with your St. Patrick's drink of choice and enjoy this episode on Banshees.
When my father died, the school teacher back the road, Mrs. Toohey, she's dead too, God rest her, she said she heard the gate opening and she heard the door of the kitchen opening. They were in bed. They didn't know he was dying. But people will tell you the banshee is queening when the McCarthy's
died. She said that's the banshee.
The banshee's there.
The awful scream. The banshee followed them, you see, when they died.
When he was found dead in exactly the same place.
We were terrified of them.
The banshee.
In honor of St. Patrick's Day, we'll be turning our attention this time to Ireland's most dreaded folkloric figure, the Banshee, or the Banshee, that is two separate words, differently spelled in Irish, meaning woman of the fairy mounds. These she are the tumuli, or the barrows, or ancient burial mounds, believed in Ireland to be the dwelling place of fairies. The Eshi and Dainashi are the modern and older Irish terms for the fairies making their homes there. However, as the character has been known since the 17th century, the Banshee doesn't quite fit into the traditional world of fairies, not in the way this world duplicates the social structures of the human world with its palaces and courts and royalty and games and amorous relationships. The Banshee, as it evolved in the early modern period, is very much a solitary figure. Her primary occupation is mourning, and not in any reserved or quiet way, of course. The scream for which she's known is a wail of grief that betokens the imminent death of someone close, and traditionally this would always be a blood relative. This sound, by the way, would never predict one's own death, as the dying person never hears the banshee. And the scream certainly never causes death, as some modern horror stories or movies might have it. The Irish are famous for their unrestrained emotive funeral customs, which in the old days included dedicated mourners, often professionals, who were called keeners, from the Irish word quena, or lament. Sometimes, as in the province of Leinster, you'll even hear the term banshinta, meaning keening or crying woman, substituting for that less descriptive banshee, which is just the woman of the mount. That's a 1957 Smithsonian field recording of a keen, a funeral lament, from the Aran Islands at the mouth of Ireland's Galway Bay. But it's probably not something you would ever hear twice, as keens aren't necessarily raw and improvisational. The keeners, who would often arrive in groups of three, would rock back and forth and incorporate tearful wails and gasps and repetitive nonsense syllables called vocables. Sometimes also they'd thump rhythmically on the coffins. Keeners would take turns in a sort of handoff process, marking the end of their verse with one of these syllables or a characteristic gasp. And then the next keener would pick up from there. Familial and ancestral relations of the deceased would be enumerated, like the beloved Mary Fitzsimmons, born to the father of this name and mother of that name and granddaughter of this and that person. She's lost to this poor grieving husband of this name and son of these people and so forth. Though the banshee's wail was usually merely an inarticulate howl, in some instances there are similar verbal elements, these enumerations of the mourned and the mourning. Now, while the banshee's cry is known for a horrible piercing quality, coming from the fairy realm as it does, it could also have a sort of otherworldly beauty. For instance, Lady August Gregory, the dramatist, folklorist, and one of the writers behind the Irish literary revival of the 19th century, she mentions this quality or quotes a local who mentions it, one only identified as Old Simon. This is in her 1920 book, Visions and Beliefs in the West of Ireland. Simon says,
"I heard her beside the river at Ballylee one time. I would stand barefooted in the snow, listening to the tune she had, so nice and so calm, and so mournful."
While most frequently accounts of the banshee mention nothing but a wail coming from some invisible source, others do sometimes describe the appearance of a figure, usually at night and near the home where the death will occur. So, as to the descriptions, in a culture where the woman's hair would more often than not be put up in some way, the banshee's hair is invariably described as being long and hanging in a disheveled way or even floating about her. And, of course, this is because the idea of neglecting the customary fixing of one's hair would be taken as a sign of grief, particularly among older women. And the banshee does frequently have the gray or white hair of elderly women, or sometimes also red hair, possibly due to the color's association with passion. Her depiction as elderly could simply be a way to suggest her ancient ancestral link with the family, or it might relate to the fact that keening was often performed by older women, particularly as the custom began to die out. As a mourner, her eyes are also sometimes described as being red from weeping. Though there's the extremely rare report of a banshee of unusually tall stature, if her height is mentioned at all, it's often because she is unusually small. This would seem to be something inherited from the fairies, at least in more recent centuries when fairies were imagined in this way. The banshee that followed the previously mentioned Old Simon, for instance, was described by him this way.
"I looked down and saw a little woman, very broad and broad-faced about the bigness of the seat of that table, and had a cloak about her."
Cloaks are often mentioned, though this would be nothing distinctive for a woman out and about in Ireland of the day. But another curious bit of dress is also sometimes included. More than once, I've run across 19th century reports of the banshee appearing with a petticoat over her head. In both cases, it was a red one. This reflects a custom of keeners in the country who would also appear with petticoats or shawls used like this, at least in rural settings where presumably they substituted for the sort of silk mourning veils that might be used more in the cities. Another unexpected detail I encountered is the clapping banshee. The 1910 book by Thomas Johnson Westrup, A Folklore Survey of County Clare, for instance, describes this sighting from the mid-1700s.
"A little old woman with long white hair and a black cloak running to and fro on top of the side wall, clapping her hands and wailing."
As you might have guessed, clapping was also part of the keener's performance. We find this clapping again in the 1825 book, Fairy Legends and Traditions of the South of Ireland, by Thomas Crofton Croker, in which he recounts another story from the 1770s, one of the banshee that heralded the death of his own great uncle. A servant, who is initially taken to be drunk by his incredulous mistress, makes this report of another daytime banshee sighted along the road.
She was along with me, keening and screeching and clapping her hands by my side every step of the way, with her long white hair falling about her shoulders. And I could hear her repeat the master's name every now and then, as plain as I ever heard it.
Another habit of the banshee, which is quite frequent in the old stories, is her use of a comb. Now, while this conflicts with what I said earlier about unkempt hair, I believe this element has been carried over from mermaid stories, as we'll later see a connection between banshees and bodies of water. Whatever the case, it's very common. The banshee is sighted combing her hair, or perhaps even more common, her comb is found or stolen by a human. A case of theft from the banshee like this is the one instance I'm aware of in which the banshee actually causes a death of a human. That is, she whisks him away to the other side. But more often, the comb must be returned to the banshee, who will show up at the home of the person possessing it. The return must be accomplished without actually touching the banshee, and is usually done by passing the comb through the window on a shovel, or held in iron tongs. Iron, of course, being a sort of a kryptonite for the fairies. One story even mentions using red-hot tongs, which would seem a bit excessive, perhaps. Now, the banshee serves as a death omen only for certain families, old families. Sometimes it's said there are only five families, the O'Neills, the O'Briens, the O'Connors, the O'Gradys, and the Kavanaughs, but this is really often contradicted. While there is a certain status to having a hereditary banshee, the family banshee is actually more dutiful than snobbish. As D.R. McAnally reports in his 1888 book, Irish Wonders,
though descendants, through misfortune, may be brought down from high estate to the ranks of peasant tenants, she never leaves nor forgets them, till the last member has been gathered to his father's in the churchyard.
And she is not bound to the Emerald Isle. She monitors the status of family members overseas, and there are many stories of families of soldiers dying overseas alerted to the deaths back home. Or there's a case of the banshee that's said to have appeared to the family of the Duke of Wellington when he expired at his castle in England. John Seymour and Harry Nelligan, in their 1914 book, True Irish Ghost Stories, tell of a party on a yacht on an Italian lake. A mysterious guest is sighted among the partygoers, but when a member of the group asks their host, a Count Nelsini, about the woman, he refuses to believe there is anyone unaccounted for. A moment after posing this question, however, the guest spies her again and screams and hides his face.
"What is it?" asked the Count. It was a woman of no earthly type, with a queer-shaped, gleaming face, a mass of red hair, and eyes that would have been beautiful but for their expression, which was hellish.
But then the Count reveals,
"My family name is, as you know, Nelsini, which, little more than a century ago, was O'Neill."
Unsurprisingly, then,
within 2 hours, Nelsini was seized with a violent attack of angina pectoris and died before morning.
While the appearance of the banshee to these particular families would be a dreaded event, it is, in the main, not an act of malevolence. But there are definitely outliers here, situations in which her attachment to the house would be more like that of a vengeful ghost. Possibly the first banshee account to make it to print is this type. It's an anecdote recorded in a memoir written by Lady Anne Fanshawe, recounting her life with husband Sir Richard Fanshawe, an English ambassador to the Spanish court under Charles I and II. The incident takes place in 1642 during a visit by the couple to the house of Lady Honora O'Brien in Ireland. So it describes a version of the O'Brien banshee.
"I was surprised when, about 1 o'clock, I heard a voice that wakened me. I drew the curtain, and in the casement of the window, I saw by the light of the moon a woman leaning into the window through the casement in white, with red hair and pale and ghastly complexion. She spoke loud and in a tone I had never heard thrice. A horse! And then with a sigh, more like the wind than breath, she vanished, and to me her body looked more like a thick cloud than substance. I was so much frightened that my hair stood on end and my night clothes fell off.
I'm not sure about her clothing falling off, but the next morning, their host, who was away overnight, does a bit of explaining.
'Tis the custom of the place that when any of the family are dying, the shape of a woman appears in the window every night till they be dead. This woman was many ages ago got with child by the owner of this place, who murdered her in his garden and flung her into the river under the window. But truly, I thought not of it when I lodged you here, it being the best room in the house.
So here the Banshee is more in that vengeful ghost mode. A further bit of information snaps it all into place. The host reveals that her overnight errand involved her presence at the bedside of a relative who had died at 2 a.m., an hour after the spirit's appearance. It's not noted, but I'd like to believe that he died of injuries sustained in an equestrian accident. No other explanation of this horse utterance is actually offered. Another story of a banshee, somewhat in the vengeful ghost mode. On the coast of the North Channel across from Scotland in County Antrim is Dunluce Castle, where another banshee is often said to be the ghost of one who met a tragic fate. As the castle towers directly over the sea, the most common legend attached to it describes an incident in which part of the structure, the kitchen, collapses down the cliff, leaving a kitchen boy, or sometimes a piper, as the lone survivors, saved only by his presence in some fortuitously secure niche or corner of the room. Another tale, and one more related to our theme, has a female kitchen servant, a maid called Maeve Roe, or Red, or Red-Headed Maeve, as the one that perishes in the accident, and as one who returns to haunt the castle. And still another legend presents this Maeve Banshee as a daughter that was imprisoned in her room to prevent marriage to a suitor disdained by the father. Attempting to escape on a rope ladder, she falls into the ocean and drowns, returning then as a warning ghost when the ocean is stormy or a member of the MacDonald family is on the verge of death. The room where she was said to be imprisoned is the castle's now famous Banshee's room, one that's said to be perpetually clean and free of dust, swept away by its attending spirit, or perhaps the seaside winds. Now, there's another Banshee room in another castle, also in County Antrim, about an hour south. It's Shane's Castle, and it hosts a Banshee also with a red appellation called Nenny Roe, or Red Nenny, Red Nenny with red hair. And together, these two are sometimes referred to as the Red Sisters. However, this version of the figure, the Banshee of the O'Neills in this case, seems much more related to the lore of fairies rather than ghosts. We hear a bit about her in an 1858 issue of the Ulster Journal of Archaeology, featuring an interview with a local who's been employed at the castle. The informant recounts a bit of a jumble of stories related to Shane's Castle and its banshee. In one, a servant of one of the O'Neill lords, while the two of them are in England in the town of Bath, he goes to a well to draw water, where he encounters
an old woman sitting beside it, crying bitterly and tearing her hair as if in despair.
Unable to help or engage this character in conversation, he becomes a bit frightened, and he leaves without the water and rushes back to Lord O'Neill and reports what's happened. Fearing a death at home, O'Neill immediately arranges for travel back to Ireland, but he has misread the omen. No one has died in Ireland. It is O'Neill himself who dies during the journey. And the storyteller quoted in this archaeological journal tells another story explaining why a room in Shane's castle is known as the Banshee's Room and still is. And in particular, she mentions its fine furnishings, including
a state bed of the grandest sort.
By the way, legend has it that on this bed, impressions of a reclining body sometimes appear, even when the room is known to be locked and vacant. These sumptuous furnishings, our storyteller explains, were only part of the gifts lavished upon a mysterious and beautiful woman that one of the O'Neill lords met on his travels.
He brought her to Shane's castle. Everyone that saw her knew she wasn't of this world. She never smiled, but pined for from wherever she came. Though she had no cause for that, for Lord O'Neill loved the ground she walked on. At any rate, she died, it was said. But if she did, no human eyes ever saw the corpse. There was a grand funeral. The O'Neills always had that. But the lady wasn't in it. Her own gentle people took her to themselves, as everyone in the castle knew well enough at the time.
Then, in 1816, on the occasion of a large party, the Banshee Room, normally kept locked and available for the spirit's occasional invisible drop-ins, was opened and used to accommodate guests. Of course, this was quite offensive to the Banshee, and the result was said to be a fire which destroyed much of the castle in 1816. That fire bit, at least, is documented. Along the way here, I should also mention some other figures from Celtic folklore, more or less equivalent with the Irish Banshee. In the Scottish Highlands, we have the figure of the Cognac, which literally means weeper. Her wailing similarly foretells deaths, particularly those of men lost in battles, and she is likewise attached to certain clans, though she appears not only at ancestral homes, but frequently at lakes and streams and waterfalls. In Wales, there's the Cahyraith, a name from words related to a skeleton. Her cries come in threes, and she's associated with particular parishes, the River Towy, and the southern coast of Glamorgan, between Swansea and Cardiff, where her moaning is heard before shipwrecks, along with the flickering of supernatural lights. Wales is also home to the Gwrach y Rhibyn, a death omen like the Banshee that appears at crossroads and streams, as well as the windows of the Moribund. Descriptions of her appearance, or attributes, are quite variable in 19th century folklore volumes, sometimes including
leathern wings,
or
long black teeth, wretched, skinny, shriveled arms of unwanted length,
or
long red hair, and a face like chalk, and great teeth like tusks.
Now I'm going to return to this idea of the Banshee's connection to, or identity as, fairies. I mentioned at the start of the show how there was some disconnect here, as Banshees are normally solitary figures, but we've already seen a mortal and a Banshee marry in the story from Shane's Castle, and the further back you go, the more you find these fairy-like connections as the Banshee's identity broadens beyond simply serving as a herald of death. For instance, there is a figure called Cléna, who is known as the Queen of the Banshees of Southern Ireland, particularly the province of Munster and the city of Cork. She also served as a tutelary spirit, a guardian of the old families of this region, bestowing favors, announcing deaths, and even becoming romantically entangled with these mortals. A chieftain named O'Quaif is the object of a jealous rivalry between Cléna and her Banshee sister, Eivil. The squabble results in the two Banshees taking turns, turning each other into cats. but it ends with Avil mostly gaining the upper hand, which is nice because she's the one I actually wanted to discuss. Avil's name means the lovely one, so we might assume she was more attractive than her sister. She was also regarded as a queen of sorts and was said to be constantly attended by 25 other banshees. Her domain was a bit further north in Munster in County Clare, where she was for centuries associated with a number of family lines, particularly the O'Briens. It's even been suggested that in pre-Christian times she may have been worshipped as a goddess at a particular site, always mentioned in connection with her. This is a Caraglia, the grey rock near the Palace of Kinkora, the 11th century seat of the High King of Ireland, Brian Boru, founder of the O'Brien dynasty. Avil figures into an important story about Brian Boru, that of the Battle of Clontarf near Dublin, in which Boru's men opposed an alliance of Vikings and Irish lords. In the 12th century manuscript, The War of the Irish with the Foreigners, we hear that on Good Friday of 1014, word was sent to the elderly king's tent that his son was facing defeat, to which he replied,
"Retreat becomes us not, and I myself know that I shall not depart alive. For Avil of Caraglia came to me last night, and she told me that I should be killed today."
Though Boru's forces are victorious, both he and his son, as foretold, are killed by the enemy. The death omen of the music of Avil's harp is also mentioned in another 12th century tale, The Cattle Raid of Cooley, a conflict over a stolen bull between the kingdoms of Ulster and Connacht. The hero of Ulster is Cuchulainn, a sort of Irish Hercules, a demigod whose fate is similarly foretold. We hear in Lady Gregory's 1904 translation of this tale in her book Gods and Fighting Men from 1904 that it is the music from the harp that
Cuchulainn heard the time his enemies were gathering against him, and he knew by it that his life was near its end.
He also encounters another banshee-like herald of death, not identified by name.
And presently they came to a ford, and they saw a young girl, thin and white-skinned and having yellow hair, washing and ever washing and wringing out clothes that was stained with crimson red, and she crying and keening all the time.
Cuchulainn's companion correctly interprets this image of bloody clothing or shrouds as an omen of his coming death in battle. Earlier, I mentioned a connection between banshees and bodies of water, which is what we're seeing here. And the figure who washes these bloody clothes in the stream is not restricted to Ireland. She's been termed the Washer at the Ford by folklorists, and can be found in Scotland, where she's known as the Beannich, or Washerwoman, and can also be found in Wales and Cornwall, as well as Brittany, and certain other French regions, where these washers, the Lavandières, sometimes called the Midnight Washers, are often said to have the feet of ducks, I guess, spending that much time in the water. Humans who encounter them in Brittany are compelled to help launder the bloody garments. Refuse, and you will be drowned, and if you help, your arms will be broken, twisted like the dripping garments they wring dry and torn from their joints. So it's a real win-win. But I have a particularly satisfying account of these sorts of laundrous banshees occurring in the Irish Chronicle, The Triumphs of Turlough, written about 1380. It tells of the wars between the Irish O'Briens, led by Turlough, against the Anglo-Norman de Clares. It describes three different encounters with banshees, or prophetic fairy women of that type. The first is atypical, or it's closer to the lovely figures of Cleina and Avil in a more protective aspect. This one identifies herself as
the Sovereignty of Ireland,
and though encountered at a lake, is not washing bloody garments. She's described as
a lone woman that approached them. Fair of face she was, and of modest mien, rare altogether. For the strangeness of her aspect, for the glory of her form, all as one man took heed to her, a maid with rosy lip, with soft and tapered hand, pliant and wavy her flowing hair was, and her breasts were very white.
She makes her appearance to reprimand Turlough for turning back from a particular battle in which he could have seen victory. And with her parting words, she then
ascended from them upwards in the semblance of a lustrous cloud.
The second banshee is encountered by the waters of Loch Rask. As the soldiers approach, they behold
the monstrous and distorted form of a lone, ancient, hideous hag that stooped over the bright loch shore. The hideous creature's semblance was this. She was thatched with elf locks, foxy gray, and rough as heather. Long as seaweed, inextricably tangled, and had a wrinkled, foully ulcerated forehead. Every hair of her eyebrows was like a strong fishhook, and from under them, bleary, dripping eyes peered with a malignant fire between raw, crimson-edged lids. She had a great, bluish nose, flattened and wide, copiously snorting and dripping. Her lips were livid, white-rimmed pustular that outwards turned up to her snout and downwards to a stubby beard. The crone had a mound of heads, a pile of arms and legs, a load of spoils, all which she rinsed and diligently washed, so that by her labor, the water in its whole extension was covered with hair and gory brains.
When the soldiers demand her name, she says that it is
the Dismal of Burren.
I should point out that this figure, as encountered by the English, declares not the soldiers of Turlough, who, as the book's name suggests, will be triumphant. As this creature speaks in Irish, an interpreter is called to interpret her prophecy of doom, and it is not well received.
By the perverse wretch's bitter forecast, the host was startled, and with javelins straightway would have cast at her, but on the rushing wind she rose above them.
There is a very similar banshee encountered by the Declares as they cross the River Fergus.
There they saw await them a horrific hag that in the current washed and with huge exertion dipped old armors, satin vestments, gold-threaded jackets, and smooth silken shirts with other garments of an army, so that of all the river below her was made a brew of blood and water. From the frightful being's fist, as she wrung those fabrics violently, the red blood squirted and fell, dying the river over.
Her message of doom is the same, and, as foretold, the soldiers of Dermot O'Brien rout the English declares at the Battle of Crooked-Cymroe on August 15, 1317.
Listen carefully. For you too may hear her cry.
I'm not frightened because I know she's coming to oversee my journey. She, the weeping one, she wails for the dead.
I thought I'd wrap up the show with a quick look at some cinematic banshees. And what you're hearing now is from the 2009 Australian film Damned by Dawn. If the title happens to remind you of a certain Sam Raimi movie, it's not by chance. Damned by Dawn is in no small part in homage to Raimi's Evil Dead films. While its banshee arrives traditionally enough to foretell the death of the lead's grandmother, it's pretty soon attempting to kill off the entire cast in very non-traditional, if occasionally amusing, ways.
Banshee.
Oddly enough, I'd say it's a Disney film that presented a banshee that for many was most memorable, and that would be in the 1959 film
Darby O'Gill and the Little People, rated G.
The film's based on the writings of Irish writer H.T. Kavanagh, author of the 1903 book Darby O'Gill and the Good People. And as such, it makes a fair effort to represent the folklore accurately, to the extent that a Disney film of the 1950s could be expected to. Disney had been eager to make this film for a while, arranging a 1947 visit to Ireland to discuss the project with the National Folklore Commission there. But it was, strangely enough, not until the copyright on Kavanagh's books expired that the film was actually released. Disney's promotional campaign included a peculiar attempt to suggest that he captured actual leprechauns to play the roles in his film.
I captured the king of the leprechauns.
In a 1954 episode of The Magical World of Disney, he appears alongside actors representing the leprechauns discussing the production. And the theatrical release of the film opens with an on-screen thank you to the leprechaun King Brian for his cooperation. Through the use of forced perspective sets and other in-camera tricks, the leprechauns were combined quite convincingly with actors playing their human counterparts, and even viewed today, the effect is still surprisingly convincing.
The Banshee!
The brief appearance of the Banshee, while it suffers a bit from the dated feel of the solarized optical effects, was quite terrifying for audiences of the day, expecting no such intrusion in an otherwise kid-friendly production. Though the film is largely forgotten, this particular scene seems to have left a scar on children of its generation. Now, I'll close with a quote from the website Kinder Trauma, an entertaining forum discussing movies and television and other bits of pop culture that have proved unintentionally traumatizing. In it, the writer recollects a special St. Patrick's Day screening at his school, an event complemented by green mint chocolate milkshakes.
Hysteria erupted at the on-screen appearance of the screaming banshee. The younger kids started screaming, and some were even audibly sobbing. The girl sitting in front of me on the floor became so upset, she vomited green ice cream chunks all over the back of the boy sitting in front of her. The teacher, running the projector, stopped the film, and I don't think they ever showed it again for St. Paddy's Day.
Watch your newspaper for the theater where you and your family can see Darby O'Gill and the Little People.